You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you live from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Pelton Cast, with a special guest to help us recap the Seahawks draft. You may know him as Danny O'Neill's economist friend. Please welcome to the pod, Ben Baldwin. How are you holding up, Ben?
Hello, it's great to be back on the Pelton Cast. As far as how I'm holding up, we'll get to that.
We'll see. Wanted to start out and thought it was really important to have you on the Pelton Cast after this NFL draft, because it kind of felt like the entire NFL was trolling you all weekend.
Yeah, it kind of felt that way. Seeing a GM do an air keyboard, Danny O'Neill being made fun of on air for having an economist friend and listening to what he said, and of course the Seahawks drafting a running back in the first round.
That was pretty much the ultimate troll, that draft pick. But we'll definitely get to that and lots more. Before we get there, do you want to talk quickly and give some background on the work that you've done with regards to optimization between rushing and passing in the NFL?
Yeah, so I've wondered for a while why NFL teams rush the ball so often. Anybody can look at a box score for a typical game and see that the average NFL team gains about 7 yards per pass and about 4 yards per rush. This has been mostly stable over time, with passing efficiency increasing somewhat over time. But still, teams still run the ball a lot. So on first and 10, teams still run the ball something like 50% of the time, even though if you pass, you're much more likely to get a first down. You're much more likely to score. If you pass on the first play of a drive, you're much more likely to score on this drive, and on and on and on. So I started asking people why teams run the ball so often. And a lot of the answers that people have given don't really hold up to scrutiny. So, for example, people say you have to commit to the run game to open up play action and take deep shots down the field. If you look at the evidence, there's no relationship either throughout the course of a season between how good a team runs the ball and how good their play action is. And even over the course of a given game, if you know how good a team has been running to the ball to that point in the game, there's no predictive power over how well the team will do a play action. And a great example of this is the Seahawks-Texans game from this past season, when the Seahawks ran going like 17 times for 3 yards and still just did play action every play, and it worked. So and if you look at kind of the broader scope, there's no evidence that this is true. Another one is this idea that running the ball helps the defense, which the coach of the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, said right after they took Rashad Penny, the running game helps every aspect of our team. It helps our defense. It helps our special teams. And there's really no evidence that this is true. So I've done a lot of work with all these arguments and looking for whether there's any evidence that this is true, and found that it's not true. And if there's no inherent value to them, then it stands to reason that teams are running the ball too often and probably overvaluing running backs.
Yes. I mean, the thing is, like, I'm not even interested in this as a debate anymore, because it's just resolved. Like, there's no evidence out there in favor of the pro running back position. It's not a debate. It's a finding at this point. What I'm interested in, and I don't know if you want to wait until we run through this, is why people are so resistant to this idea.
I think some of it has to do, I think there's two things. One is that these things might be true at lower levels of football, and everybody who either comes up playing or coaching, they start at junior high football or whatever, and high school football and college football. And maybe this is true at all these levels. And in the college game, I know that running does predict winning to a greater extent than it does in the NFL. So maybe kind of all this learned experience, people expect that to carry over to the NFL, even though we have a great deal of evidence that it doesn't. And another one is that people are just really resistant to being challenged and things that they believed for a long time. And it's just kind of like, my coaches told me this, so it must be true. And when confronted with evidence, people just dig into their beliefs even further.
Right. This is a significant problem with
that goes well beyond football, let's say.
Yes.
So all of this said, let's start with Thursday night. Right at the top of the draft, pick two, the New York Giants select Saquon Barkley, a running back out of Penn State. Do you have thoughts about this pick, Ben?
Oh, man. So another one of the kind of bad running back arguments is that running backs help their quarterback. So a lot of the discussion around this was, oh, they're really committing to Eli Manning. Having Saquon Barkley in the backfield is going to help him and prolong his career and extend his career. And there's really no reason to believe that that's true. So the Giants had a very prime draft position. They could have taken Sam Darnold or Josh Rosen, and they passed on all that despite having a 37-year-old bad quarterback and took a running back. So if I were a Giants fan, I would be very disappointed in the pick. For me, I thought it was hilarious until the Seahawks pick later in that round.
Right. It's like, it's okay if other teams are picking running backs in the first round because better for the Seahawks. But then it came home to roost.
It did. My parents and my sister were in town visiting, and they announced the pick was announced on the screen. I just like kind of slumped into my chair, let out a yelp, and they were like, what happened? they don't know anything about Rashad Penny. And I was like, he's a running back. And they're like, oh, okay. Cause they've heard me talk about before. So, I was happy that the Seahawks traded down, and I was hoping that they would trade down again, and then they did not.
My experience, I was following the draft on Twitter because of the fact that I was at the USA Basketball Women's Exhibition game on Thursday night and watching both the game and draft Twitter with Natalie Weiner of Bleacher Report, former Third Pelton brother. And Zach Whitman tweets, oh my God, when the pick is in at pick 27. And I have no context on my timeline for what's happened. For like a full minute, I had to figure out what did that mean. And it turned out, as we feared, the worst.
We just knew this was coming for so long. It felt like the entire offseason was set up for this pick.
It was building to this.
I didn't think they would do it in the first round, but I knew that a running back was coming. As I mentioned, even at the end of the season podcast last year, this was coming for a long time. As the Seahawks were eliminated from playoff contention, Pete was thinking about this draft pick that entire time. But specifically, can we talk about the player himself for 1 second, aside from just the idea of the player?
Sure. I mean,
wait, hold on. Ben, Penny, for your thoughts.
Yeah.
I've been waiting to say that since the moment he was drafted.
You could have even asked, like, is he worth a penny on the dollar?
Oh, man.
I was talking to Zach Whitman, who previewed the draft on the show, and both of us feared that the Seahawks would trade down and take Ronald Jones. So I think if that was the expectation, if I frame it that way, then I'm kind of pleasantly surprised because Penny at least has some experience in the passing game. So he had 47 targets, 16 of them were split out wide over the past two seasons. And this the number of targets split out wide is more than Saquon Barkley and Sonny Michel, Ronald Jones, and all these kind of running backs. So if we think that running backs don't really matter in the running game, which obviously I believe. If there is a running back who can move the needle in the passing game, then it's not quite as much of a disaster as if they had picked somebody like Ronald Jones or a Leonard Fournette type from last year. Geis, the LSU running back, all these guys that really offer nothing in the passing game. So that's kind of the silver lining, and the cloud on that silver lining for Penny is that, talking about the pass game, he's very not good at pass protection. So maybe he'd be more split out wide on passing downs rather than lining up in the backfield if the Seahawks call any pass plays in the team.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to do the meme. You don't have to worry about your running back's pass protection if you don't pass the ball.
He ranked 58th out of qualifying running backs in pass blocking efficiency, according to Pro Football Focus's college football rankings. But definitely the Seahawks see that pass catching ability as a factor here. Pete Carroll's quote after the draft, he is also going to be a three down back for us, and he can do everything. He needs to work on his pass protection, which he was not asked to do a lot of, but he will give us the ability to play him on all downs, and that versatility is really big. Ben, I'm curious, based on this value that running backs can offer in the passing game, where is the highest you would take a running back like Rashad Penny?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was actually planning on asking you this because we had our discussion on Twitter where you said, out of the two of us, I am the one who is less down on drafting running backs high. So I'm wondering if you would draft any running back at all, but you can answer after this. I think, so if it were Saquon Barkley, what is the highest I'd be willing to draft him if I were the Seahawks? And I think if he made it to the third round, or even if Rashad Penny had made it to the third round, I wouldn't hate it so much in a year where the Seahawks had a bunch of third round picks like the last couple of years. So I didn't really mind the CJ Rosise pick because he was a good receiver and used to be a wide receiver. And obviously the injuries have hampered his development so far. But if they had drafted Penny in the fourth round this year, after spending their first two picks on things that affect pass offense or pass defense more, I would have been totally fine with it. The first overall pick on the running back and then what they actually did with their fourth round pick are where I'm not quite as happy. How about you, Kevin?
I guess we're pretty much on the same page then. I think about the fourth round. I think one difference between us is, you know, your position is more that running does not matter. And my position, I would say, is more that I think running does matter in terms of success. I think it is important to be able to, you know, grind out games at the end if you're leading. But that I think that the success of a team's running game at the NFL level is driven much more by their offensive line than in that running backs are relatively fungible. And all these things that seem good about Penny, the fact that he, you know, led players in Pro Football Focus's broken tackle rate, that he's got a high speed score according to Football Outsiders metric, had the third fastest 40-yard dash among running backs. All of these things that they still don't give him that much better chance of success than someone like Chris Carson, who by all the metrics looked like he was going to be a really poor back coming out of Oklahoma State and was in a small sample last year more effective than the more highly touted running backs ahead of him on the Seahawks depth chart.
Yeah. So you've mentioned PFF a couple of times, and I think it's interesting because John Schneider said something about some of the analytics on the team favoring Penny over other running backs in terms of production after first contact. And like you just said, if you look at the PFF draft guide, he was first in not being tackled on first contact. And then he was also first in breakaway percentage. So I wonder if like they really are either referencing a lot of these PFF stats directly or if PFF stats are measuring something that is also being measured consistently by other people. But there are a few different picks where I look at the PFF draft guide and I watch the Seahawks press conferences and they made a lot of comments or very similar comments or in the PFF draft. Kind of
bio, well, so if we're looking at it, if you want to be the most wide-eyed optimist, which none of us are about this pick, the combination of what you're talking about with broken tackles and speed score, you can see what the Seahawks are trying to do, right?
Yeah.
They're looking for a player who they've had before, who could break tackles and could break away.
And with this offensive line, the ability to make yards after first contact is especially important.
Yes.
I doubt they're looking at it that way, but yes, absolutely.
And it felt to me like with this pick and this draft in general, which we'll talk about a little bit more later, it was so much about trying to recreate the offensive magic that they had in 2012, 2013. Pete Carroll wanted to turn back the clock, and he sees Rashad Penny as their Marshawn, their beast-like back. You know, that's what he's trying to fit this into the mold of. Whether that is actually true or could even possibly happen, having another situation where you can just turn back the clock on the entire offense, that remains to be seen. But to me, when I look at this pick, and you talked about this, about maybe even less just about the conversation about whether running matters versus running backs matter. And it's just like, to me, I look at this and I say they just wasted a first round pick. They took this and they got a player who they could find the equivalent player or what he'll mean production wise to the offense in the fourth round, in the fifth round, in the sixth round, maybe as an undrafted free agent. We've seen it time and time again throughout both of the Seahawks and throughout the NFL, players who are coming basically out of nowhere at the running back position and either being stars or having very productive season or even stints.
Yeah, I've seen people say Well, they had to take him there because if they had traded down again, then Penny wouldn't have been available anymore. And that's fine. They can take a running back later. And there's a lot of running backs out there, especially in this draft. So, yeah, the whole thing is just pretty disappointing.
Well, Zach Wittman made an interesting comment on Twitter over the weekend about the Seahawks trusting their own scouting too much, especially when it kind of diverged from the NFL consensus, at least as we see it from the outside in terms of where these players are going in mock drafts. And someone's response was, well, what are they supposed to do? Just not trust their scouts? Like, not go by that? And I get that. I get that reply. But what you do is you have a group of players you're interested in if you don't trust your scouts. And you try to get whoever is the best value of those players rather than falling in love with a single individual player, as I think we can agree that they probably did in the fourth round as well.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Best pick of the draft. Okay, so then the next day, after there was a running back taken high, the Seahawks draft a running back, the pundits were out. They were in full force, front offices. People were justifying these picks. So first, you mentioned New York Giants GM Dave Gettleman.
Yep.
At a very giveable moment, pretending to be typing on a keyboard to justify the people on the internet who say that running doesn't matter.
He's talking, he's directly subtweeting you.
I hope so. I'd be honored.
It would really be amazing.
But yes, I do use my keyboard when I look at data that describes what happened in NFL games. That is a fair criticism.
Wow. So you're saying that was accurate, what he did?
Yeah.
You heard it here first.
And then also, this is on local Seattle sports radio, not just subtweeting what might have been you, actually subtweeting you, Ben Baldwin. Kevin, can you play the audio?
And here's going to be the good one. How many times, Groz, are you going to chime in like we did on Thursday night and try to beat up Danny for the Economist to tell him that running backs are of no value? We were on that the whole day. Because
I like it. I'll
whole
do
evening.
It.
Yeah, because you know what Danny was saying was that he had an Economist friend, and he said, you should never take a running back in the first round.
I love it.
Unless you're the Giants, and you have the opportunity to get a franchise-changing player.
So good.
I will say, by the way, online this has somehow become Danny's little Economist friend.
Yeah, that's what I was
going to
say. In this I wanted it so badly to be Danny's little Economist friend. Because that sounds like the worst Hold Steady song of all time. I'm really sad that he didn't actually say that in the clip.
I was hoping that too.
But just the laughing at the insinuation that you wouldn't take a running back in the first round, like the guffaws at it. Oh, I love everything about it.
The idea of having a friend who's an economist.
Pure gold on the airwaves. Ben, do you have a retort?
Well, first of all, Saquon Barkley is not franchise. He's not changed franchises or even really mattered. but the laughing part is the best. They just like they laugh because it's so ridiculous that somebody would A, listen to Economist, or B, think it's crazy to draft a running back in the first round. And it's just crazy how different the divide is between the running crowd and the anti-running crowd, and this shows up in my mentions all the time, and it's just endlessly amusing.
Yeah, and I mean, it makes sense if you're someone who's like an NFL GM and has something invested in this, but that's, you know, again, it's the same thing that gets back to what you said earlier about not wanting to be challenged in your beliefs and presented evidence with this. But it's fascinating to me how much people who have no vested interest in this whatsoever want it to be true that running matters.
Yeah, even Seahawks fans, they really, when they're confronted, they really grappled with how important Marshawn Lynch was to the success of the Seahawks, and like calling into question his importance is kind of blasphemous. And it's not that he wasn't important. He was in 2012 and 2014, he was a very efficient runner, high success rate, high DVOA, whatever. So having him was definitely better than having whatever running backs were last year. But if I say Russell Wilson was a lot more important to the success of the Seahawks than Marshawn Lynch, people just lose their minds. It's crazy.
In defense of the Seahawks front office, at least they seem to be somewhat more progressive than Dave Gettleman. They weren't making fun of anyone. They were using analytics to justify their pick. They just don't seem to have gotten that particular part of the message about running backs and how important running is overall.
The Seahawks were? Wait, what quote in particular are you thinking of?
Well, the one that Ben referenced earlier about him saying that our analytics suggested that he would be... One other thing we didn't mention that I think the Seahawks love about Rashad Penny, the fact that he never missed a start at San Diego, or never missed a game at least at San Diego State, compared to the injuries they've had at that position the last few years, I think surely a big factor.
Another thing Gettleman said in that press conference was, in defending the running back's positional value, someone asked him about the durability concerns of the position. He was like, everybody gets hurt. It's football. Which is like, yeah.
So good.
So the Seahawks and the Giants weren't the only teams to have maybe reassessed this offseason somehow their perspective about the value of the running game.
Well, based on the Eagles winning the Super Bowl with all the resources that they've invested in.
With their multiple first-round running backs. Playing the Patriots also. I mean, you know, an Eagles-Patriots Super Bowl, when you see that, you say to yourself, you need a first-round running back.
But the Patriots apparently saw that and said to themselves, we need a first-round running back. I did not see that coming.
Yeah, that was a shocking one. Well, so across the league, Adam Schefter tweeted this, return of the value of the running back. There were five running backs selected on day two, bringing the total up to eight so far, tied for the most running backs taken in the first three rounds in the past 10 years.
If only Tom Haberstroh were on this pod, he would sing Return of the Value of the Running Back to the song Return of the Mac.
Return of the Back? Yeah.
Yes.
Why is this happening? We can let running backs die in 1 second, but why is this happening? Is it just because the Jaguars happen to have become a very good team after taking a running back high? I mean, you have these success stories from last year, teams that were surprisingly good, and the running backs that they had who are all highly selected, like Alvin Kamara, not as high as somebody like Fournette, and then Todd Gurley and the Rams.
Yeah, people point to Gurley and Elliott, for example, and ignore what happened in Gurley's first two seasons and then and Elliott last year. Even when Elliott came back, it's not like their offense suddenly became good again. I think this year was legitimately a good running back class, at least according to people who have takes on these things. So that probably played some role. But yeah, it seems like NFL teams are very slow to kind of grasp the relative importance of rushing and passing.
Yeah. Seahawks foremost amongst them. All right, let's move ahead through the draft. The Seahawks, with the pick they acquired from trading down, finally got into day two of the draft with the 79th pick from Green Bay and used that to take USC defensive lineman Rasheem Green. This seems like a very Seahawksy pick.
Yeah, young player with injury concerns who can maybe rush the passer. Sounds a lot like somebody they last year.
Right.
Although I guess some people had injury concerns. He was maybe playing on injuries in his final season. Yeah, they've been looking for a player in that mold who can rush inside and outside, hopefully. And they're trying again. So here's to hoping that it works out better this time.
Yeah. Green won't turn 21 until next month, despite having 3 years of experience at USC, had six sacks as a sophomore and then 10 as a junior before declaring early. And the expectation here is that, and I think he'll probably play outside on run downs. He's not necessarily considered a good enough run stuffer to play in the middle there, but then slide inside on passing downs and provide some interior pass rush, which is something for which the Seahawks have been searching for a few years here.
Yeah, so I, according to PFF, he was number 21 in snaps per inside pressure and number 57 in snaps per outside pressure. So I guess the hope is he'll increase his productivity outside, at least to start.
I thought it was notable, by the way, John Schneider's comment about Green. Great workout. Had a really great workout this past spring, the same day that Darnold worked out. Is it possible, just maybe, that they were more interested in going to see Rasheem Green, who they ended up drafting, than Sam Darnold, who went there?
I don't know. Crazy theory I developed.
The takes were hot.
Did they draft somebody from Wyoming later in the day?
They did not.
Think about it.
I haven't looked at their other draft prospects. I grant that.
But the way that they described Rasheem Green, I mean, you talk about where he's going to play. They just described Michael Bennett. I mean, that's what this is,
the best possible version of Rasheem Green describes Michael Bennett.
But you also have to like this pick for the upside, getting somebody who's so young, and this is pretty deep in the draft at this point, getting somebody who's been productive at the college level and is incredibly young. I mean, he still has room for growth, a couple more years on most players who you're drafting.
How do we think about age? Because if they're super young and we're projecting improvement, what if the improvement doesn't come until like the end of their rookie contract and then they're not cheap anymore?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I mean, I think the fact that, you know, there was some talk about maybe he'll need a year or two to develop in terms of the strength necessary to play at the NFL level, but it's not like someone who was unproductive at the college level and that you're just hoping will develop into a productive player at some point. Like, he's been a productive player, so I feel better about his chances of contributing.
Handle that in the NBA when teams are looking at players who are so young?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my projections for players in the NBA, it's based on their first five seasons. So, you know, the 4 years you've got them on their rookie contract, and then the fifth year that you'll always have under team control if you make them a qualifying offer as a first round pick. So if you are someone who hypothetically are so young that you would peak after that, it would be factored in to that analysis, but still age ends up being a very important predictor of success, and you want to draft younger players, all things considered.
Okay. And the other thing is, you just can't have, as the Eagles demonstrated during this draft, you can't have too many defensive linemen. There's no team where you say to yourself, we have so many defensive linemen, we just can't get them all on the field. There are many downs where you're going to be pressuring the quarterback, and having a rotation there is huge. And it's something that the Seahawks really lacked last season, and having kind of this amazing rotation where they could bring in various different players and put them in the right situations. And this, hopefully, what we said a year ago with Malik McDowell, hopefully this will be a step in that direction.
And then they traded their best pass rusher.
if they get someone who can pressure the passer in the third round, then that's a win. I'd be happy with that.
In the fourth round, it turns out the thrill was not gone.
Oh, the thrill is back, baby. We're just high-fived.
I feel like Ben is not high-fiving about this pick as much as you may like Will Disley.
If only we drafted a Stanford tight end.
So this is Danny Kelly's fault, and the reason why is Danny was on a podcast called Setting the Edge, which I really enjoy. And they asked him, it was a couple of months ago, I think, like early in the draft process, who is the most obscure draft prospect that you have studied so far? And his answer was Will Disley. So I'm blaming Danny for putting Will Disley on the map, because, of course, it must be his fault. So here we are.
It's good to find someone to blame.
The Seahawks have loved Will Disley from the moment he moved from defense to offense.
Pete Carroll said that we thought he was the best blocker in the draft, and John Schneider compared him to Zach Miller, which is fellow Zach Whitman stepping up for his fellow Zach, pointed out people who are comparing Will Disley to Zach Miller are significantly underrating Zach Miller.
This reminds me of airing of grievances, and Kevin's grievance was how often the Seahawks run out of heavy sets, right? And we're going to see so many heavy sets this year.
So many.
But when Will Disley is leaking out on a play action on one of those heavy sets and ambling down the field deceptively fast, Will Disley, we are going to love every single second of that.
Just like the one time Nick Bonnett caught a touchdown in 2017, there's going to be one moment of glory for Will Disley in 2018.
Question about Will Disley for both of you. Will he see a snap on defense this season?
I mean, I think it's unlikely, but I guess it's plausible.
If he does, then a lot of people probably got injured. Right. So maybe.
I mean, maybe he lets you go with one less defensive lineman on your game day 46 because you feel like in an emergency you can play him there. But I don't expect this to be – you compared it to Will Tukuafu playing.
I was going
to
say, this is a team that played a fullback on defense not that long ago.
He did convert in the NFL, right? Not like at the collegiate level.
That sounds right.
So we were feeling pretty down about the draft, I think, at this point.
I was not feeling down at all.
Not the famous cousin Katie, who is very in on the Will Disley pick, in on picking any Husky. I was feeling pretty down about the draft at this point. And then that Seahawks roller coaster, just when it was at the bottom, it mustered up the steam and managed slowly to get up the hill and reached a new height with the drafting in the fifth round of Shaquem Griffin. How awesome was this?
I still haven't watched the video that everyone's talking about, so I really need to do that. I'm kind of saving it until I'm over everything else that happens, and then I could feel happiness again. So I'm really looking forward to that. But yeah, it's great. The story's great. Being united with his brother's great, and having all that in Seattle, it's really cool.
What I like about this pick, besides the storyline aspect, I mean, Shaquem Griffin was an extremely productive player at the collegiate level. And one thing that I expected this offseason that I don't think we've really seen is more of an effort to improve the team's speed on defense. Like, to me, the number one takeaway from the Rams game in particular at the end of last year was you looked at that Rams defense and you compared it to the Seahawks defense, which once was so fast flying around defensively. And the Seahawks looked old and they looked slow. Granted, Bobby Wagner was playing through injury in that game, and that was a big factor in it. But they really haven't done much to improve their team speed on defense. I mean, maybe you can argue Barkevius Mingo could be that. Perhaps that he's going to play at strong side linebacker. But this is a guy who, to the extent that he'll get on the field defensively and probably be primarily as a special teamer early in his career, this guy is going to bring speed on defense.
He's fast.
When there's the clip from they were playing in the Sugar Bowl, right, UCF? Whatever bowl game UCF played and won, where in the fourth quarter of that game, you can see there was a tweet about it. Somebody was mentioning that Shaq Griffin is just moving at a different speed as everybody else who's out there. He's pressuring the quarterback. He's making huge plays. He was involved in every single play. And that was in the fourth quarter at the end of that game. He just looked like a different kind of player. This is not against, you know, weak competition in this game. This was not a typical UCF game. He was playing in a big stage and he was making huge plays there. And to me, honestly, the thing that's most shocking about it was that he wasn't considered better than a fifth rounder, because the production is there. The raw tools are there. Is the only question just having one hand?
I mean, people mentioned size. And again, Zach Whitman pointed out on Twitter that his closest size comp was Deion Jones at the Falcons. So that probably shouldn't be a major concern.
Yeah. PFF called him a pass rusher in a defensive back's body. So I think that's the concern with where he actually fits in. In 2017, he had four different games where he pressured the quarterback at least seven times, which is kind of insane. So if they're able to get any of that out of him, where he's able to rush the passer maybe on third down, then like we said earlier, any added pressure on the quarterback is a bonus.
Yeah, and I'm intrigued by the talk that he might end up playing strong safety in the NFL. I mean, clearly he's got enough speed to play that position. And, you know, it's just a matter of whether his instincts and tackling are strong enough to hold up there. So I hope that the Seahawks said afterwards that he'll start at weak side linebacker, backing up KJ Wright at that spot. But I want to see him at multiple different spots, I think.
Yeah, his body certainly seems like it's probably more suited to strong safety. And that would be a very interesting fit and would certainly make the Seahawks faster.
Yeah. And worst case scenario, we know that he's going to be a useful special teams player, which Pete Carroll said that he's shown us he has a great knack for.
Yep.
Okay, so even aside from all of this, the productivity, everything else about Shaq Griffin, Shaquem Griffin.
Yeah, be careful there.
Just good on the Seahawks here, right? I mean, you go into so many drafts saying, we want this player, we want this player, we want this player, especially in the second, third, fourth rounds, and you're never getting those players. There's so many teams. Can you think of the last time that the Seahawks targeted a player? I felt strongly about Russell Wilson a few years ago, which worked out. The last time that you went into a draft and you saw like a third round pick or something that you really wanted the team to get, and then they came out of it, and this year they got this year they got, Shaquem Griffin, pairing him with Shaquille Griffin. The story of him making the NFL, the grit, the perseverance, being told that he couldn't play at this level because he had one hand, and now he's reunited with his brother in Seattle. How awesome is this?
I think I was really into them drafting Kevin Pierre-Lewis based on Zach's stats, and that didn't work out the best.
Yeah, I was extremely excited when they drafted Christian Sakoli because of Zach. And
I should have asked that question.
We'll always have Christian Sakoli.
This is amazing. It's just like you don't like get fired up and fist pump about fifth round picks all that often.
Are you saying that you weren't fist pumping about Trey Flowers?
No. Well, I was not.
I have to look him up.
Trey Flowers, another very Seahawks-y pick.
Do you have any thoughts about Trey Flowers?
It seems like he has the prototypical body for what the Seahawks like in their DB converts. So if there's anything that we still really trust, or at least that I still really trust Pete on, it's identifying these guys and turning them into players. We saw last year the other Shaq Griffin being drafted in the third round and turning into a good player in its rookie season. So let's hope they keep the magic going.
Yeah, I don't think we should expect it to be this immediate contribution from Trey Flowers. I think it's more down the road. I thought it was interesting that like his pass coverage was considered a weakness as a safety, and then you move him to quarterback. Like that seems that's troubling. But Carroll's comment was that he had a great workout with our scouts and showed us some of the change of direction stuff that would apply at the cornerback position. So I think this is going to be a long-term project probably.
Yeah, he runs fast and he has long arms. So what else can you ask for?
All right, speaking of high-fiving and celebrating picks in the fifth round, the Seahawks trade up 7 spots because they were worried that someone ahead of them was going to snap up a player they were so excited to add that they thought could revolutionize one of their units. And that player, of course, was a punter, Michael Dixon from Texas. Ben, we know you have punting tanks. Get them off!
So I took a nap yesterday during the draft, which maybe wasn't smart, but I woke up and I looked at my phone and the first thing I saw was Zach tweeting about the Seahawks turning up for a punter. I was like, is this real? and they did. And it's a good thing they did because they beat the run-on punters that came afterwards, which is a phrase I never thought I would say. Well, the run-on punters part. So at first I thought this was like, what are they doing? They're trading up. And yeah, it sounds bad, right? But I can't believe I'm saying this. But if you look at how good he actually was, maybe it's not so crazy. So we know they're going to run the ball a lot in 2018, which means they're going to punt a lot. So if they're going to punt a lot, then might as well get a good punter. So there's this article on SB Nation, and the first sentence is, Michael Dixon is one of the best punting prospects of all time. That sounds great. Sold.
I mean, I would be curious to find out who the rest of the best punting prospects of all time were and how well they actually turned out in the NFL, among other things.
So the punting analytics here are the Longhorns were number one in Bill Connolly's punting success rate. So that's presumably an EPA-based metric on punting success. So if he can reproduce that in the NFL, then it's kind of something that's meaningful. So the Rams have had very good special teams, and their punter, Johnny Hecker, is probably not a realistic comparison, but it shows that there can be an advantage in having a good punter. Seahawks Twitter got really into punting a few weeks ago because we started looking at EPA-based measures of punting, and I found that Marquette King, the punter released by the Raiders, had a higher EPA per play than Derek Carr, which is just one of the favorite things I've ever discovered when playing with NFL data. So this led to a couple of weeks where a few of us were just tweeting punting stats nonstop. So, of course, the culmination of this is the Seahawks trading up to draft a punter.
Yeah, if the previous pick is Danny Kelly's fault, if the Will Disley pick is his fault, then this pick is definitely your fault, Ben.
That's totally fair. Either the Penny pick or this pick is my fault, or maybe even both of them, but I really can't deny it. Yeah.
Will Disley also is your fault.
Yeah, everything is my fault. They just hate...
You're taking responsibility for all these.
Everything I stand for so much that they just had to devote an entire draft to proving me wrong, and hopefully they will. We'll see.
Right. The Seahawks, a little anonymous friend. One response to the Broncos front office, if this is true that they were quote unquote.
I don't think this is true.
This is apocryphal.
This person did not appear to be well sourced if you looked at the rest of their timeline.
Okay. So I don't have to retort to the Broncos front office. Fine. I'll save it.
Okay. I mean, again, there was actually a punt run on punters. J.K. Scott from Alabama went later in the round, who seemed at one point like he was clearly going to be the top punter taken in whatever draft he went in, but amazingly he was not because Michael Dixon came on the scene. I mean, the immediate response that everyone had on Twitter about this was obviously the Seahawks are cutting John Ryan.
Yes.
Because of the significant cap savings that they can get there, a saving of, let's see here, $2 million this year and then $3.6 million next year if they were to cut him now, because John Ryan is making way too much money for a punter. I mean, that's not necessarily a reason to go out and use a fifth round pick on a punter because you can replace John Ryan with anyone. But also, John Schneider afterward made clear to point out, we both love John Ryan, so this is all about competition. And we use a fifth-round pickup punter and doesn't work out, then so be it. That's a paraphrasing of the second part for the record. What?
Fifth-round pickup punter. I really think this is a good pick. I mean, just assuming that they are going to release John Ryan, you save a significant amount of money on the cap, and you have a chance to get the best punter in college, one of the best punters ever, maybe coming out of college. Why not?
Because you should never punt. You should go for it on fourth down all the time.
That ain't happening. They're going to punt a lot.
I know.
Yeah. So I have in my notes, one of the things I wrote about this was that the cutting John Ryan, saving $3 million, whatever, as a reason to draft him is not really a great argument. Like Kevin said, because you could replace John Ryan in cheap ways that do not involve using a fifth round pick. So I think the move is somewhat defensible, but not because they can save money by cutting John Ryan. They should have done that anyway. Given that they needed a punter, which I was surprised that John Ryan was even still on the team. Maybe they're just waiting for the draft. And we'll see if this competition actually happens. But I would be pretty surprised if John Ryan were still on the team in 2018.
I mean, I think the stronger argument in terms of using a fifth round pick on a punter and trading up to use a fifth round pick on a punter, no less, is the idea that Football Outsiders floated many years ago of robo punter, a punter who could punt every time and have it roll out of bounds at the 1 yard line every single time. How valuable would that player be? And it's possible. There's an outside chance that Michael Dixon could be a robo punter.
That'd be
great. How valuable was that player, by the way?
I don't know if that thought experiment was ever settled.
Robo Punter win the MVP?
I think that may be part of the discussion. I'm not sure. It was a while ago.
All right, we'll find out this year with Michael Dixon.
Yeah, the takes are hot. In the sixth round, the Seahawks took edge Jacob Martin from Temple. It will probably slot in as a defensive end for the Seahawks. His brother Josh is a 5-year NFL veteran who played for the Jets last season. And Martin came into his senior season with just one career start, but had 8 sacks as a senior. John Schneider described him as, quote, a fit guy for us with a huge motor. So there we go. That's what we know about Jacob Martin.
That's as much as I know now. Well, I think we skipped a pick too.
Oh, you're right. We did skip a pick. We did skip with the fourth and final.
After the punter, things really slowed down in the Ox draft.
Because I didn't have any notes on the fourth and final fifth round pick. Ohio State tackle Jamarco Jones, other than that they plan to play him at left tackle to start, which seems not ideal for his ability to get on the field anytime soon with Dwayne Brown at that position and presumably George Fant as well.
Yeah, I have one. The one notable thing about this is that I was told that in the press conference, John Schneider said that they're planning or considering having George Fant play right tackle, which is definitely news, I think.
That is
news. So that's interesting.
I did not see that in the quotes that I saw. So that will be interesting to monitor. All right, with the final pick, the Seahawks drafted Mr. Magoo. Florida International quarterback Alex Magoo, who was a 4-year starter at Florida International, had a solid completion percentage aside from completing about 50% of his passes in his freshman season because true freshman quarterbacks are bad. Averaged no better than 6.6 yards per attempt until his senior season when he broke out with 7.9 yards per attempt. He averaged more than 75 rushes per season playing in a spread option offense. Not great averages in terms of yards per play, although obviously sacks count against your rushing yardage in the college football, which remains a terrible thing. He ranked 54th in the NCAA last year with a 61.5 QBR, which put him 4 spots ahead of number 7 overall pick Josh Allen and 26 spots behind Jake Browning. I mean, the Bills, they weren't specifically taunting you, Ben, me, but they were just taunting anyone.
They were taunting themselves.
They're fans.
I feel bad for Bills fans. Going from Tyrod Taylor, who's like not amazing, but not terrible either, to eventually Josh Allen is going to be so depressing.
Hopefully at least Mina Kimes gets a good think piece out of it.
Yeah.
Schneider's comment on this pick said, there's this category now called off the spot where you just watch this guy play where he's got to move. And of all the guys in this class, Baker Mayfield was first, which makes sense with his movement skills and his eyes. In terms of completion percentage, Mayfield was at 58%, which is really high. Magoo was at 54%. He was second. And Sam Darnold was third at 48%. So therefore, Alex Magoo, top 5 pick.
That was the one thing that wrote down from the press conference too, and I tried to find the source for this and couldn't find it anywhere. So I'm wondering if they have some sort of proprietary scouting or measurement or something on this, which is all the other kind of metrics that he referenced, I could find some sort of source for, and it was mostly PFF, but this one I am not sure about.
So this is a stat on play completion percentage on plays where they were forced out of the pocket or had to move around in the pocket.
Something like that.
We don't know. We know nothing else about it.
We know what the John Schneider quote says. That's all we know.
I'm happy that the Seahawks are looking at that, though, because it means they're being realistic.
Oh, yes. That's a good point. That's a great point.
Yeah. The thing about that is when you're trying to predict how well somebody will be at passing in the following year, the best predictor is how will they do when not pressured. So this is like kind of the thing you don't want to be looking at.
That was kind of mind-blowing to me, that information. That was a PFF study over the offseason, because of the fact that it seems like one of the issues that young quarterbacks struggle with in the NFL is that they can be reasonably effective from a clean pocket, but anytime they get pressure, they struggle.
Yeah, and this is both for NFL predicting NFL success in the following year, given a player who is already in the NFL, and projecting college players into the NFL. The more stable metric was success in a clean pocket. So maybe it's just like accuracy and knowing progressions and things like that before things get crazy, and then once you're pressured, then there's so much randomness that eats up all the signal or something like that. That's my guess.
That's very interesting. I mean, that makes sense, that basically things that happen when you have to move in the pocket are more or less luck,
but smaller sample size, so yeah, you
know. Unless you're Russell Wilson, then the samples are pretty similar. Yeah.
So one thing that did not happen during the draft is Tristan learned, much to his amazement, while recording an episode of Tasteful Profanity outside of a wine bar on Thursday night.
Oh, man.
The Seahawks did not trade Earl Thomas. He is still a Seahawk.
Can I just say how disastrous I thought the first round was?
Yeah, you really thought it was bad.
It's so funny hearing somebody foreshadow something that doesn't actually happen, but they think it's going to happen. I've never heard this in an actual setting, and it's just so funny.
So do you have any additional thoughts now that you've kind of gathered yourself a little bit from this news that Earl Thomas has not, in fact, been
traded? I'm happy that they didn't trade Earl Thomas. I don't know. You know, I think this is kind of more of a where the team is going from this point question. And to me, this is not what the Seahawks have done, both with this draft and this offseason, is there's no complete rebuild happening. Pete and John are looking at it like they wish the offense was what it used to be and want the offense to look like it used to look. But to me, this is not a team that's going into next season's not saying that they're contenders. And I think that keeping Earl Thomas is part of that, and why they wouldn't waver on kind of what they're going to get for Earl Thomas is they're saying they're going to compete next year. You know, they're not looking at 4 or 5 years down the road. Pete Carroll is too old to do that. But it makes sense in line with these draft picks that you would keep Earl Thomas and kind of keep kind of the core of your defense there and go out there and try to compete as much as you can next year.
It's interesting that despite the loss of Bennett and Sherman, it does feel like the defense is going to have a pretty similar feel to the end of last season. Byron Maxwell, in another piece of news, re-signed over the weekend on a one-year deal reported is worth up to $3 million. So it looks like you're going to have him and Quill Griffin at the outside corners again, Thomas and McDougald at safety, and that Barkevious Mingo and then whatever happens at defensive end replacing Michael Bennett are really going to be the most significant changes to this defense going forward.
Yeah, I could see them finishing like as the number 10 defense or something like that.
Was there anything in this draft that they didn't address that you were surprised by, Ben?
I was really hoping they would draft a wide receiver somewhat high. I don't know if surprise would be the right word, but the I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed kind of applies here. Looking at their receiving options, they have Doug Baldwin and Tyler Lockett, and not a whole lot behind them, unless they're really high on Darbo, who didn't really do a lot last season. They let Paul Richardson walk, they let Jimmy Graham walk, and they signed a blocking tight end and then drafted a blocking tight end. So if Doug Baldwin or Tyler Lockett goes down, then they're going to be so thin on receiving options. And even if they don't, there's just not a lot there. So I was hoping they would take one of the late round gems that Zach revealed on this podcast, at least, but they just really did not go that direction.
Yeah, I mean, I already mentioned the place that I was surprised that they didn't address in terms of team speed on defense. How about you, Tristan?
Mine was just the wide receiver thing.
Yours was also wide receivers.
Yeah.
Ben mentioned thinking that the Seahawks could still finish 10th on defense. Where do we feel about the Seahawks' offensive potential, given the lack of targets now for Russell Wilson, the lack of skill position talent, and the fact that we can now expect that the Seahawks are going to run the ball a lot?
I would guess maybe 15th or something, like an average offense.
That might be optimistic at this point. Oh.
God, you're the worst.
We have a good quarterback and not much around him. So is Russell Wilson good enough to pull them to an average offense by himself?
But is Russell Wilson even going to be given the opportunity, or is he constantly going to be in 3rd and 7 like the entire season?
So they will have to throw the ball once when they're in 3rd and long all the time. So hopefully when they let Russell throw, then he'll be able to do something with it, which is basically what happened this past year. And maybe the run game will regress to the mean a little bit after investing so much in it.
It couldn't possibly. Well, actually, hold on. Knock on wood. Maybe it could possibly be worse.
I think it really depends on what the offensive line looks like and how much there's just a Tom Cable regression in the mean that happens. We can't go into next season saying that the Seahawks haven't invested heavily in this offensive line. You know, they have experience together, most of them as a group, what looks like it'll probably be the starting core. They have Dwayne Brown in the fold for a full season. I honestly think that this offense will be like the 10th best offense. I think Rashad Penny is going to get a lot of credit for it, whether it's deserved or not. I think he's going to get kind of the regression to the mean boost that a player like somebody like Leonard Fournette got last year. And I think that the passing game in particular will be very efficient. I mean, they still have Doug Baldwin as a weapon, who's one of the better receivers in the NFL, still have Russell Wilson. And if this line is, I don't know exactly how much better they need to be, 50% better than they were last year. If they're not the worst offensive line in the NFL, I think that this offense is going to move a little bit.
They already weren't the worst offensive line in the NFL, and it might have been the guy whose team they hired the offensive line coach from.
And they might have two of the worst pass-blocking guards in the NFL this year. So in Posick and DJ Fluker, is that right? Yeah, so I think they were like maybe both bottom three in pass protection last year. So unless Posick takes a big step, then we're going to be facing a lot of interior pressure again on pass plays, which is not a good thing for the offense.
And not a good thing facing that Rams defensive line. You know who is not believing that the Seahawks are going to finish 10th in both offense and defense and therefore be a solidly above average team? That's the good folks in Las Vegas. The West Superbook Las Vegas, putting out their new playoff odds in the wake of the draft, have the Seahawks at plus 220 to make the playoffs, implying about a 30% chance of that happening, putting them 8th among NFC teams right now, behind naturally both the Rams and the much ballyhooed San Francisco 49ers and their new wide receiver, Dante Pettis.
That sounds about right. They were 9-7 team in actual record, by point differential, by Pythagorean wins, pretty much everything, all the evidence we have points to them being about a 9-7 team. They lost a bunch of talent and didn't replace it. So being 8-8 or middle of the pack in the NFC sounds pretty reasonable.
Yep. Well, we'll see. I mean, part of that is just being in a very difficult division, or what looks like at this moment a very difficult division.
What is touted is a very difficult division. Let's go with that.
Football is a weird sport. Things change very quickly.
They do.
In football, our perspectives about teams change very quickly. The thing that almost always is a constant and is important to have is a great quarterback, and nothing in this draft changed that.
But the other thing that's important to have and a constant is a great front office and coaching philosophy. And I think that's the one thing here. Like, our faith in the Seahawks front office and coaching staff had already been pretty severely shaken by this offseason. And I think this was kind of, the draft was the capper on that. Like, look, I'm not saying that these moves aren't necessarily going to work, because there's a lot of randomness in the NFL. People hated the Seahawks draft in 2012, where they ended up with Russell Wilson as well as Bobby Wagner. It's one of the great drafts now in NFL history, that draft, and people hated it at the time. So hindsight is, you know, it's difficult to predict, make predictions, especially about the future. But it seems like the Seahawks have committed to a strategy where they are making things intentionally difficult on themselves with their with their choices. I would liken it to someone who's playing blackjack and has decided to just hit on 17 every time. Like, sometimes you might get a 2 or 3 or 4 and you might look great because of the fact that you happen to pull that card. But over the long run, that strategy is just not going to work. It's proven not to work. And that's how I feel about how the Seahawks are operating right now.
Yeah, I can't remember who said this, but I think it really captures something. And they said that Pete Carroll is a very good coach operating within the constraints that he puts on himself. And and the real problem is the constraints, which are his own fault. But he thinks there is one way to win in football at all levels, and he's not going to deviate from that. And however disappointing or frustrating it may be for us, then that's what he's going to commit to, and he's going to either that way or go down trying.
Well, we'll see whether they succeed or go down trying. We are now, what, barely 3 months away from the start of training camp. So we've gotten through a significant portion of the long off season, but still more yet to come. We'll be back with our regular pod later this week. Hope to have Zach Whitman join us again to break down the draft further and get off his takes, because we know they are fiery hot in Zach's case. But it was very good to be able to do this today and go through what had to be one of the most frustrating weekends of Ben's life.
Thank you to our little economist friend. Thank you for joining us, Ben B.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure and honor to be here. And go Hawks.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thanks.